So today we're talking about psychology. So I call this lecture Psychology 101. Typically in US universities, they have numbers for classes, and the 101 is always like the first basic class in any subject. So it's a reference to that. I don't have a background in psychology. Has anybody here studied psychology? Okay. I have to.
Cognitive science.
Oh, yeah, that's a part of psychology, right? Well, if I say stupid things, correct me. So, my goal here is to tell you about a few things of human behavior that are of particular interest when we design or evaluate user interfaces. I was going to say something else before that. Okay, it will come back. So, the point is that je suis fatigué. I'm tired. This is deadline tomorrow night. Next week I'll be in great shape. So we study human-computer interaction. There's the word human in there. So we need to know a little bit about humans. At least you need to know what you don't know. It's always useful to know what we don't know. One of the reasons why designing user interfaces should be a multidisciplinary endeavor, combining people with technical skills, with skills on human behavior, and design skills, is because one cannot master all of these topics. And of course, psychology and human psychology is a big topic, right? So here I'm going to focus on things that are, I think, immediately relevant to HCI. Historically, psychology has seen several, stages. We are still in the stage that we call cognitivism, where people study cognitive science. Before that wave of cognitivism, there was another wave in the 60s and 70s called behaviorism. Now, behaviorism was about studying how the behavior of animals and humans and try to figure out how to control this behavior. Behaviorism was not really interested in what's happening in the body and in the brain to explain why we create and have these behaviors. It was just studying the animals and humans from the outside. Then came the cognitive revolution that says, well, behaviorism is bad, it doesn't explain anything, and we are going to go and look in the brain and tell you how all of this works. I think it's fair. The study of science is to, refine our knowledge of things, and of course we want to understand how our brain works. The little problem I have with cognitivism is that it tends to concentrate on the brain and forget that we have bodies, that we have senses, that we perceive, and that we act, and try to reduce everything to what's happening in the head. And moreover, I have to say, a lot of the cognitive models are, if not inspired, influenced by the fact that, the brain is like a little computer or a big computer. And truth is, we don't really know how things like memory work at the, chemical level and things like this. So it can be useful to make analogies, but we have to be also careful to not overinterpret these analogies and reduce the brain to a computer. I emphasize this because when you design interfaces, it's very tempting to assume a certain behavior from the user. And if the user is not doing the thing he or she is supposed to do, then it's the user's fault, right? It's always easier to blame it on the user. You designer did it right. Those stupid users, they just don't get it. So get me new users. So I'm going to put most of the emphasis in this class today on action and perception, and we'll say very little about the cognitive side of things. Not, again, that I think it's not important, but I think that when you interact, it first happens through your senses to perceive, through your body to act. And so if we don't understand what's happening at this very physiological, physical level, I don't think the stuff we can say about how the brain works are necessarily very relevant. The other thing about the classical approach in psychology, like in many sciences, is we study things in isolation. So you have entire books on vision, for example. Then other people study hearing, and then other people study emotions, and then etc. And of course, we need specialists to study these things. But the stuff that we want to use in HCI is more holistic. We need to have a more global understanding of things. And in particular, if you follow this cognitivist view that, okay, we perceive stuff and there are signals going into the brain does things and then controls some output, which are our muscles, essentially. And the result of this is that people have studied perception, what we see, what we hear, what we sense when we touch, independently of how we act. But in reality, perception and action are tightly coupled. So, assume you all know that the reason we can perceive three dimensions, even though we only have two eyes, is because we perceive depth. Yes? Wrong. This idea that, you know, my eyes are little cameras, they each get a slightly different image because they are side by side, and then my brain is recomputing this 3D model of the world based on the discrepancies between these two images. Doesn't work. It works for things that are close, but for objects that are, you know, as close as a few meters, what's perceived by the two retinas is not different enough to extract this information. So how do we perceive in 3D? I mean, as I'm in this room, I have no question about the fact that, you know, the front row is here and the back row is in the back. I don't even realize that my brain is computing the 3D model. Well, there's two things. The one that I mentioned here is that we move our heads. And as we move our bodies, or just our head, and sometimes just the eyes, the image we perceive change. And so as I move back and forth here, the people in the foreground move faster than the people in the background. That's why when you are in a train and you look by the window, the moon stays still in the sky and the trees seem to be going by. It's an illusion. Yes? So, it is because we move our bodies that we are able to perceive three-dimensional aspects of the world around us much better than when we are steady. Of course, having two eyes also helps, and all of this gets integrated. Another example where we need perception for action is touch. Now, if I ask you to open your hand, to close your eyes, and I put an object in your hand, and you're not allowed to move your hand, do you think you're able to tell me what's in your hand? No, probably not. If I let you touch the object, act on it, then you can start figuring out its shape, maybe its texture, which will tell you something about its material. So we need to act to perceive. In fact, going back to vision and our perceptual senses in general, they all work on sensing changes. Your eyes even if you look steadily in front of you, steadily at your piece of paper or something, you know, and you feel like you're fixing something, your eyes have micro movements. In fact, if they didn't move, you wouldn't see. And this has been tested. For example, some people have made experiments where they attach to the eye, I don't want to be the subject of the experiment, a little mirror that counteracts these micro movements so that what comes to the eye is constant. And what happens is you lose the sense of vision. If you think of hearing, hearing is hearing the changes in the sound waves, and it's because it changes that it actuates the things in your ear and that you get to hear something. So, short message here is we need to act to perceive. We also need to perceive to act as well. We're not very good when, if we are blind or in the dark, if we can't hear, we need to perceive the world to adjust our motion. So if I try to grab this bottle, I will certainly do it more quickly and accurately if I can follow my arm reaching for the bottle rather than doing it, you know, with looking elsewhere. When we design interfaces, you know, we create a world where we decide what are the laws of physics. A lot of things we learn as we grow up from being babies is to learn the laws of physics in the world and integrate that as we go. When you create interfaces, we get to decide on these laws of physics. And so in the physical world, we are used to things reacting to our actions. We're used to the way objects organized in the 3D world are perceived. And so it's important to understand enough of that so that when we create interfaces, we either build on these skills that we have, or if we want to cheat and not respect those laws, we need to know why we're doing it and what we can expect. So in HCI, there is an influential psychologist whose name is James Gibson. And James Gibson is the author of a branch of psychology called the ecological theory of perception. Now, the term ecological here, you know, it's not about being environment friendly. It's about the fact that, in his opinion, animals and humans have co-evolved with their environments. So, you know, evolution, of course, is a key biological concept in biology. Co-evolution is something that is less well known, but that takes into account or accounts for the fact that animals on the Earth have transformed the Earth. For example, the fact that we have enough oxygen in the atmosphere so we can breathe is because animals generated that oxygen. Okay? Do you know about this?
No.
Well, look at Wikipedia. I'm going to go way too far off track if I get into that. The point is that that Gibson is making is, in particular, our perception, our senses to perceive the world have evolved according to what it is there is to perceive in the world. It's quite remarkable, if you think of it, that all animals that have eyes pretty much have the same eye and see in pretty much the same very, very narrow bandwidth of the entire electromagnetic spectrum. How is that? It's just like, okay, we're lucky. Well, it's probably because that's where there is interesting information, more than if we were perceiving just X-rays or infrared or whatever. And so the ecological approach to perception tries to think of why is it that our perceptual senses are the way they are, and how can we explain that by what is it that there is to perceive in the environment, and why do we perceive stuff in the environment? Well, essentially, it's to try to not being killed by predators, historically speaking, right? So Gibson is quite interesting because it challenges a lot of the findings, but even methods that were used in psychology. Because in psychology, like in all good natural science, you try to isolate the phenomenon. So if I'm going to study vision, human vision, I'm not going to go out in the streets and see, how do people perceive? Where do they look? I'm going to take subjects, put them in the lab, usually stick your head so they can't move, have them look at, lines and squares and things and try to understand things from there. And Gibson says, that's not going to explain much of anything. And so his approach is to argue that our perceptual senses have evolved, so we pick up information from the outside world. We extract information from the outside world. He studied visual perception in particular, and what he's saying is, we don't have a little camera. Our eye is not a little camera. We perceive what he called an optical flow, and again, what we perceive is changes rather than things that don't change. And in fact, beyond that, what we do is we extract from these changes the invariance. The most famous one is illustrated by the cover of his book here, of his main book. It's a bird flying over the sea. And so imagine yourself being a bird flying over the ground. But you can imagine yourself in the train, but it's nicer to think you're a bird, right? So you're moving in space, and so as you're moving in space, what's happening? Things that are going by you are moving by. If you could see the thing behind you, well, they would keep moving back. And then the thing in front, if it's right in front of you, it doesn't move as much as if it's on the sides, which is what these arrows represent here. Bigger arrows mean it's moving faster than small arrows. And in fact, there is one point that is invariant, and that's the direction you're going to. So to capture your motion in the world, all your brain has to do is to extract this invariant point. And there is evidence that this is actually what our vision system does. So we extract invariants, and one way to analyze this is to say that the visual system and our perceptual systems are economical. They try to do a lot with very little. You know, we're very impressed these days by AI. I'm going to take another side route here. And AI does impressive things. But your brain consumes the equivalent about a very tiny light bulb. Light bulb. I don't remember if it's literally a few watts. Now, if you compare that with the amount of power that it takes Google DeepMind to beat someone at Go, they need something that would power an entire city in electricity. That's to beat one person, right? So, yes, we can do things with AI that mimic and sometimes surpass human capabilities. What I'd be curious to know is what can we do with the same amount of power that our body consumes to do these kind of things. I think we'd get some surprises. So our systems have evolved to be extremely efficient. And it's very tempting to analyze vision as we're doing, information, we compute on images, but this is not what's happening. So the reason Gibson is also when in fact the more important reason why Gibson is influential in HCI is because he's the author of a concept called affordances. I'm sure some of you have done studied HCI before, have heard about affordances. Yes? No? HCI bachelor? No? Yeah. Affordance? No. Okay. Yes? Yes. Oh, come on. Tell me. And affordances are, in fact, a sort of step after this notion of information pickup and extraction of invariants. And I will get back to affordances when it's time to talk about it. So let's talk a little bit about vision. Well, the first thing is our eyes are amazing things. There's not a single camera on Earth that can mimic the capabilities of our eyes. You may find this strange, but I don't know if you heard, you know, Apple released their new iPhone. Now it has not one lens, not two lenses, it has three lenses. And that's yet far from the field of view that we can cover with our eyes. It needs a lot of processing to be able to see in low light and to not be blinded in full light. Our senses are able to adapt to a wide range of incoming signal, if you want to look at it this way. So our visual field is about 180 degrees. So that's the time where every year I do a little exercise to test this fact. So what I'm going to ask you to do without slapping your neighbor is to take your arms in front of you. You're going to look in front of you, and you slowly, without slapping your neighbor again, go and you try to stop when you don't see your hands, right? You turn your head, so you're cheating. Right. Now, normally you should end up with your arms pretty much at 180 degrees. But I see eyes moving. Right? It's not something that we're necessarily aware of. Now, we can do even better. Because now that you are a little bit past this limit, and again, it's hard to, keep looking ahead because you try to wiggle your fingers, and then suddenly you'll figure out that you can actually go a little bit further. Well, so why is it important to see wiggling fingers? It's motion, yes, and? That's a danger. You know, when a predator is going to attack you, you don't care its color or size or shape. You want to know that it's going at you. And in fact, in the eye, we have color perception in the focal area, in the center of the eye, but not on the sides. And normally you should not believe me, because you have obvious evidence in front of you that I'm looking here and I know the color of the things on the sides. Yes? Well, you know because your brain knows because it's seen it before, and the brain has this amazing capability of giving us the illusion that this world around you is there and stable. But it's doing this from a very partial signal. So we have a very large visual field, which means that, we build computers that really cover, even if you have a 30-inch screen on your monitor on your desk, it's covering about 1/100 of your entire field of view. If you're, of course, using a smartphone, it's even way smaller. So we can see a very large span of the world at once, and in the focal, in the focus of attention, in the direction where we're looking, we have very high visual acuity. you know, 0.04 millimeter. That's less than half a tenth of a millimeter. Which is why you have phones today that have a pixel density of about 300, 400, they count in dots per inch, which I'll let you translate into millimeters. But the idea is that at the regular distance where you're looking, or you should be looking at your phone, there's no point in making the pixels any smaller, because it's already below the acuity of visual acuity of humans. Now, when you look at displays, big displays, for many, many years, we were way above that threshold, and we could see pixels, and we had to invent anti-aliasing and all these funky techniques to make it look better than it was. So, high visual acuity, large field of view. We don't perceive colors, and we're not sensitive to, but we are more sensitive to motion in the periphery. Perception of color is something very tricky. There are entire books that have been written, both by psychologists and artists, to try to understand colors. There is a very nice book I discovered recently. I have to remember to put the link on. That has plenty of examples of how the perception of color is affected by the surrounding. This is a well-known fact. We perceive motion, how things move. In fact, our eyes are extremely good at perceiving motion. There's this wiggle thing I did a moment ago. But another example that will tell you that is if you're looking at a tree and you know there is a bird in a tree, it's very hard to see the bird until the bird flies away, because you detect motion more easily than shape. I mentioned the perception of depth. So we perceive depth through both stereo vision and also body motion that help us understand the spatial relationships in the third dimension. But Gibson says that there are other factors. Objects that are further away, they are smaller. They have a finer texture than objects that are up close. Now, all of this affects can affect the design of interfaces. And in particular, I think the design of immersive interfaces when you are in a 3D space where we try to replicate a lot more faithfully what's happening in the real world than on a 2D interface. Now, here is an experiment that you wouldn't, I think, be allowed to do today. I hope you wouldn't. This is the Heldenhain's Kitten Carousel. So here the idea is, again, going back at this notion that we need to perceive in order to act. So here's the story. You take two newborn kittens, and you keep them in the dark. Don't worry, there's a happy ending. And every once in a while, you take them out of their dark box, and you put them in this device. What is this device? It's a stick here. These things can turn. And as you can see, the two sides are linked together so that if one is turning onto itself, the other is going to have the same movement. Now, if you look carefully, you will see that kitten A on the left has his legs sticking out of the basket here. Kitten 2 on the right cannot stick his leg out. They are stuck inside. So what's happening here? We have two kittens who are subjected to the exact same visual perception and the same self-motion, because when one moves, the other moves in a similar way. So this is all put in an enclosure that has, I think, vertical strips etc. Now, fact one, if you maintain a kitten in the dark, it won't develop vision. It will stay blind. Fact two, if you do this experiment and put these two kittens and put them in a lighted environment when they do this thing, kitten A on the left will develop vision, kitten B on the right will not. Poor kitten B. He's going to stay blind. Conclusion of Mr. Heldenhain, self-produced movement and concurrent visual feedback. So if your body moves and you get the visual stimuli that are concurrent with your motion, this is essential to develop what they call visually guided behavior, at least for cats. I don't think the experiment has been done with humans. Now, I said there's a happy ending because you're all worried about cat B, right? Well, kitten B, if you don't do this too long, and then put in the light like kitten A and let him, you know, stretch his leg and all that, then gains vision again and everybody's happy. Yes, in 1963. And I don't know if they would pass an IRB these days, an ethics board. But sometimes, you know, you need radical measures to advance science. So this is again to emphasize the importance of action and perception coupling. And I think when we create user interfaces, a lot of the user experience, as people call it, relates to this notion of whether can we engage with the interface because we see this action-reaction. We see this coupling between what I do and what I perceive. And sometimes differences in terms of milliseconds, maybe 10 milliseconds, are critical to bridge this gap between something that will not only feel sluggish, but just not right, and create usability problems, and something that people will use spontaneously. I think I mentioned was in the first class that on the first iOS on the iPhone, when your finger approached the screen, everything else stopped, so you could have this what journalists like to call butter smooth scrolling. But that makes a big difference because people get it. Now, the thing is, a lot of the work on vision has tried to play tricks to our visual system to understand how it works. I don't know if you've ever seen an Ames room. So an Ames room is a room where you have a side where from the outside you can view inside through a keyhole, and then typically you go with your friends or family, so one person looks, and you put the other people in the room, and then you get, so here it's twin sisters, and they're in the same room, and one seems to be half the size of the other. And you look at it, and it's like, what's happening here? Now, there's a trick, but not a trick that involves, I don't know, some weird lens or something. It's just that the shape of the room is not what you expect. When you look at the room from the vantage point of the keyhole, it looks like a regular square back wall. In fact, the back wall is like this. It's also distorted vertically, so it has the right distortion so that seen from here, it appears flat. And because we are trained to live in buildings with flat and vertical walls and all that, we use that as a cue, as a reference point, and then we try to adjust the rest accordingly. And that's why, even though these two kids are the same size but a different distance from the viewing point, I feel this is a flat back wall, and so this person must be smaller. So it's easy to play tricks on our visual system, for better or for worse. Now, if anybody knows this, don't say anything. So we're going to watch a little video. Did it start? I don't know.
the monkey business illusion. Count how many times the players wearing white pass the ball. The correct answer is 16 passes.
Yes?
Did you spot the gorilla? For people who haven't seen or heard about a video like this before, about half missed the gorilla.
So who missed the gorilla?
If you knew about the gorilla, you probably saw it. But did you notice the curtain changing color or the player on the black team leaving the game?
Uh-huh.
Let's rewind and watch it again.
So the curtain is red.
Gorilla, and there goes a player, and the curtain is changing from red to gold.
And we saw a player go out. There are only two black.
When you're looking for a gorilla, you often miss other unexpected events. And that's the monkey business illusion.
Okay. So who knew about this? Okay, well, you guys are well, you watch too much YouTube videos. who didn't know and saw the gorilla? Okay, better on the right side here, one there. So the others, you didn't see the gorilla? No? Okay. Who didn't know about it, saw the other changes. Okay, which one? The curtain? You saw one black person go? Yes? The red to gold? Curtain two. Okay. Well, maybe some of you are more sensitive to color and others to movement. I don't know. So now, why is this interesting for us? Right. So as an interface designer, you're tempted to say, well, you know, I'm going to put on the screen this information and people will see it. Well, not necessarily. So there's a lot of literature that's trying to figure out, you know, what are the rules to make notifications get noticed, for example. How to make change visible. Another example here is you know, classical game of seven errors. You look at these two pictures, what's the difference? One, two, three, four, five, two people have raised their hand, three. Okay, now we got a few. So you were the first. Yes? Behind?
Behind.
All right, I'll help you. Yes? So this big patch of tree is not there in the other picture. It's a significant change, but takes a while to spot it, right? So the short story is, visual stuff is hard. We know lots of things, and sometimes I feel we know nothing. We have all the scientific knowledge. That scientific knowledge is not necessarily the easiest to apply for us designers of user interfaces. Artists and graphic designers also know a lot about the visual system. When the impressionists came up and figure out that they could do with this swaths of colors generate images that were seen as real. Or the pointillists that are doing this, you know, all these little dots to create images that when you're up front you don't see anything, but from afar you see it. To be a good artist, a good painter, etc., you need to understand things about the visual system that maybe you cannot put words on, maybe you don't have a theory for, but you know there are these phenomena out. When you look at typographers, when you look at graphic designers who design posters or visual layout, they also have this capability, this ability of knowing what is not what is right and wrong, but what works and what does not. What will drive the eye from that point to that point? How to emphasize a particular thing or de-emphasize it. And so I think this is why it's so important, again, to know what you don't know. If I design a visual interface, I know it's going to look crappy. I know what kind of things I need to put in my interface for it to work, but to make it really work, I need to work with a graphic designer who's going to use his skills. And graphic designer are good at static things. When you start using animation and other things, then you may want to turn to other specialists. Having said that, there are also a bunch of basic rules that everybody should know. The fact that if you want to create an animation to be fluid, it has to be at least on the order of 30 images per second, for example. That reaction time to get the feeling that something is physically reacting to your action, it has to be under 10 milliseconds, and things like this. So there's basics you need to know, and also the fact that you need to work with specialists to understand the rules. I would say of graphic design would be the most obvious for our topic. Okay, in a vision, let's talk about hearing. So hearing, like the visual system, we have a very large dynamic range of hearing. You can hear tiny sounds and as well as a plane takeoff. Don't be too close if you don't want to destroy your hearing system, but it's a very wide range. We have also abilities that are yet to this day not well understood. The most famous one is the cocktail party effect. So when you go to a cocktail party, do you go to cocktail parties? No, you just go to parties, right? So when you go to a party and there are groups of people speaking in different parts of the room, right? You can stand in a place and you can actually focus your attention to one group versus another. And that's really stunning because the signal coming to your ear doesn't change. I mean, you can't move your ears. You have to move your whole head and like your eyes. You could move in the room, of course, to get closer. But even without moving, you can actually focus your auditory attention to one point or another. And we don't really know how this works. More generally, when we hear multiple sources of sound, there are a certain phenomena that we understand reasonably well for which different sources are going to be heard separately or, on the contrary, masked one another. You all listen to MP3 music. Yes. Well, MP3, compared to the signal that's on, a CD, is a lot smaller. So they had to compress it. And they had to do what's called lossy compression because you don't have enough bits of data to put all of the signal. So what are you going to drop? Well, MP3 heavily relies on this notion of on these masking rules to remove from the signal things that you don't hear, or that most people don't hear. And so it's based on the relative frequencies of different parts of the signal, and if you have a 3D sound, it's also depending on how separated they are from each other. Now, of course, hearing doesn't work in isolation, and we perceive the world through both, we perceive the distant world both through hearing and sight. And so our brain is used to correlate what we see and what we hear. Now, there are experiments that if you put someone in front of a curtain, apparently speaking, but in fact, it's a loudspeaker in the back of the curtain that is creating the sound. If I offset the position of the loudspeaker with respect to where the person is, even though the loudspeaker, the sound is coming from 2 or 3 meters away from the person, because you see her mouth move, and if she's doing proper playback, you will feel like it's coming from the person. And that's because visual sense for humans dominates hearing. Now, if you go too far, of course, you will start hearing that there is a disconnect. Sound is not used very heavily in user interfaces. I mean, it's used to, you know, provide alerts, essentially. So you have the various gling-glings when you get called on Skype or some kind of service. You get the dings of the various notification when you get a message. But it's usually used to distract you, at least to inform you of outside events. There's very little use of sound as part of the interaction, which is very unfortunate because sound, you know, we tend to overload the visual channel by putting all bunch of things on the screen. A lot of information could also be conveyed through the auditory system, through sound, and it doesn't need to be loud sounds. I mean, again, our ear is very good, at least your young ears, better than mine, at hearing very faint sounds. Bill Gaver is a researcher who, in the early 90s, late 80s, worked at Apple and created what's called what he called the Sonic Finder. So he added sounds to the Finder interface so that if you clicked on an icon of a file or if you dragged an icon of a file, the sound it made would tell you the size of the file. So big objects make lower pitch sounds and tiny objects are. But also the type of sound, whether it sounded like you were hitting wood versus glass or metal, would tell you about the type of file that you were manipulating. And so when you were dragging an object, you would hear whether you were dragging a folder versus an application versus a document. So what's interesting there is that the interface was conveying information through the audio channel that was not available visually. When you see an icon of a file, you don't know if it's a small or a big file. Now, these days, whether it's small or big doesn't really matter. At the time, you know, you had a 400K floppy disk, so you were careful with the size of your documents. Unfortunately, Apple was ready to put that as a regular feature of the operating system. And they, story goes that they gave a demo to journalists, and of course, to give the demo, they turned up the sound. And it scared everybody, saying, well, yeah, I don't want to work with this thing. It's going to make all these sounds as soon as I touch it. And so they killed it. I think it's unfortunate because I think there's a lot of information could be conveyed in a subtle way through sound that is not exploited these days. And in the same way as there are visual illusions, like we saw the Ames room as an example, there are also auditory illusions. So this is one of my favorite ones. It's called the Shepard Rissé tones. It's probably a sound that you've heard before. I'll just play it. So what are you hearing? Yeah, so it's going down and down and down. But how can it never stop? There is a trick.
There are two tracks. One that's going down, and the other that's higher than the loops.
Well, there is not two, but five or six. So they take a frequency. That frequency is going down. But when it gets too low, it sort of disappears, and there are other ones that come in the meantime. So at every point in time, your ear locks onto one or two of them that are going down, but then you sort of lose them, so you catch onto another one, and it feels like it's going down continuously. Now, of course, you can do this in the other direction. I learned recently this is an effect that's used quite heavily in movies. Not as, you know, up front in your face, but in some scenes where, like here, you want to, you know, make people depressed, you play that kind of thing. But you put it sort of in the background or with some music in front, and it does affect the people. So the visual equivalent of this is, you know, the Escher's infinite staircase, which I'm sure you've seen before. The staircase is well known. He also did this one with an infinite fountain here. And so it's the same thing, is that when you look locally at this, it's right, and it's only when you sort of step back and see the whole thing that it still takes some time to realize where the trick is, playing with the perspective. Now, I think visual illusions and auditory illusions can be interesting for HCI. Because in fact, this very sound we used to provide feedback about an operation such as downloading something when you don't know the size of the thing you're downloading. So if you're downloading an object and you know its size, you can have a sound that's going to start from one pitch and finish at another, and you know when it's at that pitch, it's over. But if you don't know the size, what you want to convey is how fast it is downloading. And so what we did was to link the speed of the download to how quickly the sound was going down, or if the download got stuck, the sound would sound steady, right? And so this way, you could start a download and just hear what was going on. You didn't need to have a visual feedback. So this is the kind of tricks, in a sense, that can be useful to provide users with information without overloading the visual signal. Okay, now we've done vision, we've done hearing. Next. Oh, next is a big one. Touch. By the way, how many senses do we have? Five? So vision, hearing, touch. What's left? Taste and smell. Okay. I'm going to skip taste and smell, I'm telling you already. There is work in the area, but it's really... But touch is a big one for various reasons. First, we have all this pretend touch interfaces, which I don't think they are touch at all, but we'll get to this in a minute. The other thing is that touch is, in fact, can be seen as multiple senses in one. And that's why I talk about TPK, tactilo-proprio-kinesthetic. That's a good one to learn to impress your friends and family. So first, there's the touch, which is about touching. So putting, say, your hands on an object, and we immediately realize that to touch things, we need to have friction between the object I'm touching and the part of my body. If I just put my finger on something, I cannot tell much about it. But if I rub it, I can tell the difference which when you think of it is amazing, between the surface of the table versus the piece of paper versus a plastic bottle or whatever. So we have amazing receptors here to sense the minuscule changes in pressure according to the surface we're touching. Now, this is sensors that react to changes in pressure and in changes in texture. But we also have other sensors that react to changes to vibration. We have sensors for heat, we have sensors for cold, and we have sensors for pain. So all of this are intermingled into this is an enlarged part of your skin. Yes?
What does heat stand
for? It will come in the next slide, so don't worry. So now why do I say that these touch interfaces that we all use today are not touch interfaces? Because when I touch my screen, all I touch is a flat, cold piece of glass. Whatever is on the screen, I don't touch it. I just touch the damn piece of glass that is on my phone. So I don't get, well, I get a very crude touch stimulus, which is always the same no matter what I do. Now, there is work in the labs to try to provide, weird things are happening when I touch my phone randomly. There is research to try to provide touch stimuli by, for example, vibrating the screen or through a electrostatic. So you know, sometimes when you touch a fridge that is poorly grounded and you move your hand, you feel a little. yeah, it's not. Yeah. Well, they try to do this to generate different touch perception. So, in fact, the objects you see on the screen could also have a texture. But currently, these are not touch interfaces. So that's the touch that we call the haptic sense, because it's about really physical contact with an object and stimulating some of these sensors. So it's a T of TPK is touch. Then P is proprioception. Proprioception is about knowing the configuration of your body in space. That's something we don't even think about. You don't need to look at yourself to know if you're standing or sitting, or if your arm is extended or along your body. You just know. Well, how do you know? Something is to tell your brain, right? Because you could say, well, I know I'm standing because I told my body to stand. But if someone pulls your arm up, you know where your arm is. So there are receptors in the joints that, you know, send all that information and allow people to do things like eating with their closed eyes or touching their nose, like here. It's also the sense that is used to perceive the shape of an object. So when I put an object in your hand and you start touching it, it's from the perception of the positions of your fingers that you reconstruct the shape of the object you're holding. Now, this is very important typically in virtual reality applications, because it's already hard to do touch when you're not touching anything. Proprioception can be exploited to give you a sense of objects you're manipulating, but that's hard. And then we have the third component, which is the K for kinesthesia. Now, kinesthesia is about being able to feel the weight of an object or the resistance of an object. And these are receptors that are not in the joints this time, but in the muscles, how much muscle you force you apply. And there are a number of sensors that exist these days. The first one was the Mayo, that actually sense your muscle contractions, and that can be used to detect the types of movements you're doing just by sensing the muscles in the arm, for example. Now, all of these are important if we work on embodied interaction or interaction that involves the entire body. So that's true in virtual reality and some of the types of application. The hand itself is just a magnificent tool that we've been given. The number of degrees of freedom that you have in your hand, the level of acuity you can have in movement, in precise movement and large amplitude, the acuity we have to perceive textures, as I mentioned, etc., makes the hand really an amazing tool. And if you think of the way we interact, we provide input to computers through a keyboard, through a touch, again, wrong word, touch surface, or through a mouse, I mean, it's exploding a tiny fraction of what we are able to express with our hands. I'll talk later in a later course about gesture-based interaction and the challenges that it raises, but there is tremendous potential there to enrich the channel of communication with the computer. To be absolutely complete, there is in fact a fourth. Well, so some people call that a different sense. Some people attach it to the TPK, but it's what's called a vestibular sense. It's a sense of balance. So if I stand on one foot and I close my eyes, I'm probably going to lose my balance, and I know I'm losing my balance. And that's not proprioception. That's not kinesthesia. In fact, it's a sensor in our inner ear that tells me, hey, you're falling. It's the one that also gets confused and gives you vertigo. And of course, all of these, in particular, the visual, kinesthetic, and vestibular senses work together so that, for example, we are able to walk and run and jump and not fall over too much. This is relevant to research in virtual reality. In virtual reality, there's a lot of issues with cyber sickness, and that's because however good we are at creating visual, in particular stimuli, because of lag and because of other effects, our brains detect some discrepancies and makes us sick. And I'm afraid, ladies, that women are more susceptible to cyber sickness than men. That's been tested time and again, and that's the way it is. So, okay, so we talked about the five senses. I skipped smell and taste. I added the vestibular sense. Now, what about the action side? How do we act on the world around us? Well, we act through our motor system. We can control our body movements for locomotion, walking, running, etc., for physical action, moving our body and typically our limbs, gesturing, hand movements, which can be very precise. We can also have strength, and the particular types of muscles, which makes our vocal cords move, which in turn emit sounds that we call sometimes voice. So voice, because voice conveys language, of course, we don't think of voice as you know, moving your body the way you move your arms. But at some point, to emit those sounds, you need to control muscles in your larynx. So I'm not going to talk about voice and speech and all that. That would be another entire course in itself. What I want to talk about the motor system is that it's a very complex system made of what's called kinematic chains. So I have a shoulder connected to my elbow, connected to my wrist, connected to my fingers, which has finger joints. And same thing on my legs. Now, an articulated body is something very clever because it allows to combine amplitude. I have a range of, close to 2 meters by extending my arm. But I can have very small movements with the tip of my fingers that allows me to, for example, write teeny letters on paper or do very small tasks like soldering or things like this. So the ability of the motor system to combine amplitude and precision is, I think, an interesting thing in evolution and allows us to do many different tasks. The thing I wanted to get to is this notion of kinematic chain was used by a French psychologist called Yves Guillard, with whom I've had a chance to collaborate and still collaborate, who has studied how we use our two hands. Now, something interesting is that when you look at the human body, it's very symmetric. We have a right hand, we have a left hand, right and left legs, and they look exactly the same. Yet, if we observe people using their hands, they use them very often for most tasks asymmetrically. And what Guillard observed was that when you do a task like writing on paper, your dominant hand, which is the right hand for right-handed people, your dominant hand is going to do the precise task of doing the writing. Your non-dominant hand, even though you're not aware sometimes, is setting the context. So these two guys here are writing on paper. I noticed your pad of paper is up here because you're at the bottom of the page, and yours is down here because you're in the middle of the page. I'm sure if I look at you in 5 minutes, yours will have shifted there, and you have turned the pages and moved it down. In fact, Yves Guillard did an experiment where he asked people to write, to take notes on a paper where he had put a carbon sheet of paper in the back, so that when they write on paper, they write on paper, but it also leaves a mark on the table itself. And he had two groups of people. One could use their two hands, and the others were not allowed to use their non-dominant hand. I didn't tell them, of course, what this was about. They took the notes. At the end, it pulls out the thing and looks at where are the marks on the table. And sure enough, those who could use their non-dominant hand had moved the piece of paper so that on the table they were writing on a very small area. And the other ones didn't have a choice but to, adapt to work like this. And if you see, when you're pouring something in a glass, when you're chopping something, when you're cooking, pretty much every action that involves both hands, you'll find this relationship that the left hand for right-handed, so non-dominant hand, acts first to set the frame, doesn't need to be very precise, and then the dominant hand comes in and does the precise task in the context set by the non-dominant hand. And that led to an interface design where, for many, many years, and still today, it looks like computers were designed for people with one hand. There was one mouse, now there is one trackpad, and now we use one hand to hold the phone and the other one to tap on it. At least gives the left hand something to do. But on the desktop interface, why aren't we using the two hands more effectively? So tool glasses were created by people at Xerox PARC. You remember Xerox PARC from yesterday's class? In the early 90s, they created an interface that had a mouse and a trackball. And I'm going to show you a short video, so it'll be more clear immediately. It's called the see-through interface.
You are looking at the screen of a Sun Microsystems SparkStation 10 running the Cedar programming environment. user's dominant hand and a trackball plus thumb wheel for the user's other hand. This region of the screen contains a simple window system that we will use to demonstrate two new user interface techniques, Tool Glass and Magic Lenses. Tool Glass is a movable transparent control panel that appears above application windows. We can move a sheet of Tool Glass in two ways, by dragging it with the mouse or with the trackball. Using both input devices, we can move a Tool Glass sheet and the mouse cursor simultaneously. A transparent control panel enables new kinds of user interface tools. For example, this color palette is a set of buttons called click-through buttons. Clicking through one of these buttons changes the fill color of the object beneath. These buttons work over several applications, including a graphics editor, a rectangle editor, and a text editor. Tool Glass requires only coarse positioning with a non-dominant hand. To make use easier, sheets can be scaled up or down using the thumb wheel. A Tool Glass sheet can have many layers, called tiles. We can navigate through the sheet by moving to the next tile, back to the previous tile, or use an overview tile to move directly to any tile. A Tool Glass tile may contain several tools, perhaps grouped by function. This tile, for example, contains four tools used to change the graphical style of an illustration. The line weight tool changes line thickness by clicking through the desired line weight. The line color tool changes line color using click-through color buttons. The fill color tool changes fill color in a similar way. Finally, the font face tool sets the typeface of text clicked through it. Some tiles have several copies of the same tool. For example, this tile contains two clipboards. A clipboard can copy an object, move, and paste it somewhere else. Clicking in this little box clears the tool for reuse. Using multiple clipboards, we can pick up several objects to be pasted either into this picture or into another one. These modified clipboards...
I think I'm going to stop here because I'm going to run out of time. So the point here is that it's a bimodal interface. It's inspired by the way we use a ruler, or what's called also a French curve, where you position it with your left hand, and then you operate on it with your right hand. So you see here, you have this tool glass, this transparent set of tools that floats above the surface of the screen. You move it, and then you click through. So in one action, you specify the command you want to apply, change the color, copy, paste, etc., and where you want to do it. And in controlled experiments, they showed that tool glasses were 40% faster than traditional techniques where you go to a tool palette and you come back and forth and all that. So that's an example where an exploitation of a good understanding of our physical capabilities allowed to have a much more efficient type of interface. So the last thing I want to mention briefly, because I will get back to Fitt's law later in the course, is that in psychology, there are very few areas where you have quantitative laws that allows us to make predictions about how efficient something is going to be. And so, it's important to have knowledge of psychology to do HCI, but at the same time, it's not like, well, there's a set of formulas and I just need to apply them and then, my design will be better. There are no formulas. There are very few formulas, and one of the few ones, and by far the most used in HCI, is called Fitt's law. And what it does is it predicts the time it takes to go from one point, you say your cursor is one position on the screen, move to what's called the target, can be an icon, can be a menu item, can be a link, and predict how long it's going to take to do this pointing gesture. A pointing gesture is something you do hundreds of times a day. And the efficiency of the interaction is entirely determined by your ability to move your arm and fingers quickly enough to the target and to not miss it. The computer cannot do anything for you there, right? I mean, it's just waiting for you to click somewhere. So Fitts' law shows that the movement time to click something is a linear function of something that is the log of 1 plus the distance to the target divided by its width. And that's, I wouldn't say intuitive, why is there a log, but the fact that it takes more time to go further away and it takes more time to get to smaller targets makes sense. What's interesting with this is that if I go twice as far, I don't double the time. It's a logarithmic function. The other thing is that it's d over w that counts. So if I double the distance but double the size, the time is the same. So it's what we call the scale invariant. This has been used heavily to assess the performance of pointing devices like mouse and trackpad and etc., but also direct pointing, touching with your fingers. And this has been used also to help design better pointing techniques. And there will be a part of a class where I'll talk about how we can beat Fitts' law and have the computer help us point more quickly. And to finish on the part of generating output through motion, of course, we use gestures to point at things and to control an interface through input devices. But gestures are a very rich channel that can be used for direct action, but also for other things. So Claude Cadoz, a French researcher, has put forward three roles for the what he calls the gestural channel. The epistemic role, which is through gestures, by touching objects, I can acquire information. I can tell what object, what's from the texture or from its shape. There is what he calls the ergodic function, which is that through physical action, I transform objects, like this guy doing pottery or this other guy breaking what I guess this one has made before. So physical action to transform objects. And gestures are also used for a semiotic function, which is to emit and transfer to emit information. So if someone is standing on the side of the road with this sign, at least in France, you know it's a hitchhiker, wants to get a ride. A conductor, you know, is doing gestures in the air. He's not playing an instrument, but he's communicating information so that the performers can coordinate their actions. And so in HCI, of course, we've used this type of channel, the ergodic channel, a lot to communicate information through physical actions on input devices that get translated into acting onto virtual objects. But we don't use the epistemic and semiotic action very much. Epistemic would require the system to give us touch stimuli, and I said that, you know, this is not really there today. And semiotic would require that we establish a communication language with the system. Now, we'll talk about gesture-based interaction, where you can draw some gestures that get interpreted by the system, and that's kind of a crude form of information-based communication. But again, it's very, it's quite marginal today. Okay, I promised the TAs who are coming in a minute that I will talk about one thing. So the last section I have here is about what's going on between perception and action, i.e. what's going on in the brain. Huge subject. I wanted to talk briefly only about memory, learning, and problem solving. So, very quickly, memory. We have different types of memory. For a long time, this was classified as short-term memory, like remembering a phone number between, you know, reading it and dialing it. And long-term memory, which was seen as something with infinite capacity, unlimited duration. Sometime you die, so I don't know what's happening to memory after that, but Since then, this notion that we have these two types of memory has been challenged by neuroscience. And in fact, nowadays there are models with many different types of memory. So we have the sensory memory that's used to process sensory information. We have the working memory that exists. But then the long-term memory is a lot more complicated. There is explicit versus implicit, declarative versus procedural, episodic versus semantic. This is really complicated. I think the thing to remember, if there's one thing to remember here, it's that we learn things, so we acquire things and put them in our memory based on repetition. It's by doing things again and again. If you observe a young child, you know, he's going to put a ball on the table, the ball is falling. He's going to put it again, it's falling again. You know, then that's how he learns basic laws of physics. But it's also through rehearsal, through practice, that we learn to, you know, play the violin or the piano or touch type on the computer, or also that we learn how to use the software, the fact that the menus are organized in a certain way. So we learn through repetition, and therefore that's why we need to have systems that help us learn by allowing us to explore things, to try things out, so we test things and progressively we create mental models of the world out there so that we can make plans to execute tasks. And that notion of how we go about the real tasks in the real world has been studied, of course, by many researchers in cognitive psychology. But Don Norman, who is a cognitive psychologist who's had a lot of influence in HCI, I'll get back to him in a future class, has come up with what he calls the seven stages of action, sometimes known as the theory of action. Not sure I like the word theory there, but that's a different topic. So the seven stages of action, according to Don Norman, is that when you have a particular goal in mind and you want to have the system, to interact with the system to get to that goal, you first form an intention of how you are going to reach that goal. Then you specify the actions that are needed to get to communicate to the computer so you get to that goal. So that's a planning stage, if you wish. Well, in order to start writing my report, I will need to, you know, turn on my computer, and then I need to find the word processor, and I'm going to fire it, and I'm creating a new document. So it's all these stages. And then you execute those actions. You actually do it. And that's where the system comes in. I mean, in this whole section here, the system is, you know, doing nothing, seeing nothing, doesn't know what's your plan. Then you execute this action, they are fed into the system, and then the system does something. Well, it does something or it does nothing. If you start typing furiously at your keyboard and nothing happens on the screen, it tells you something, right? Something is broken. But let's assume the state of the system changes, so you perceive that change. And once you perceive that change, you need to interpret it. It's like, oh, I click that and suddenly have a new thing on the screen. Well, yes, this is what I was expecting because I was opening a window. And then once you have interpreted the signal, the feedback that you received from the computer, you have to evaluate it. Is it what I had in mind? Was that what I was expecting to do? Was that my goal? Now, of course, this happens at different levels of scale. You have the grand goal of, I'm going to write my report, chopped down into little goals like, you know, writing the different parts, like, and then to opening this and clicking that, etc. So that's the sort of theory that has driven a lot of design approaches in HCI. trying to understand how the systems is designed in such a way that going from the intention to the execution can be simplified. So the idea is that clicking an icon, dragging it to the trash, is seen as more direct, smaller execution distance than having to type a command in some command language, which requires having learned it and remembering it and knowing all the syntax. On the other side, dragging an object to the trash and seeing the trash get bigger and the object disappear is easier to interpret and evaluate than typing remove file, return, and then I get the prompt, and then I have to understand, well, it didn't complain, so it has worked. But the truth is that even an experienced user of the terminal, immediately after doing remove file, it will type list to see, is it gone? Even though they know, but you have this need to get the feedback from the system, right? You had a question. The system is a stage. Yeah, I know, it's weird. Now, this idea that we have this kind of we plan, we execute, we interpret, and etc. has been somewhat challenged by a famous anthropologist, Lucy Suchman, who was in fact employed at Xerox PARC, who conducted studies of people interacting with technology and wrote, I mean, her thesis is called Plans and Situated Action. And she has shown, and this work has been extremely influential, that, well, we do some planning, but we don't plan for every possible course of action. So I plan to make a copy of a document because, you know, she was working at Xerox. I go to the copier, I put my thing, I push the button, that's my plan. Now, I didn't plan, well, what happens if it's out of paper or if the thing is unplugged or if there's someone else using it. And people improvise as they go. So they have plans, but they also have situated actions, action in the situation. And users of computers, they're the same. They have a general idea of what they want to do, but they adapt to the context and they react according to the situation. I will get back to Lucy Suchman when we do an overview of theories in HCI. And now I want to finish. This is the last slide, which is what happens when people make mistakes or when the system doesn't behave as it should. And typically, if your system is in a particular state, you have one goal there, and you've decomposed it so that you know that your next goal is this state here, which is on the way to getting to the final goal. So I know that in order to start writing my document, I need to open a new document. So that's my expected state, and the end goal is to have the document open so I can start typing. Now I'm going to do an action, and maybe this action will get me to the expected state, in which case I'm golden. But maybe it will get me to a different state than I was expecting. And there, what do? Very briefly, because I'm really late, and they're not here yet. Three things. If you are not confident with the system, if you don't have a good mental model of it, if you've never encountered the situation, we can say, ooh, undo. Get back. Get me back where I was so I can start over again. Okay, we all know that. Now, second strategy, you know the system better. You say, oh, yeah, this happened. I tried to open this file with the wrong application. I'm going to repair. So I'm going to try to get to my initial expected state, but from this new current state, so I don't have to go back and start over again. And then there's the expert behavior, and that's to say, oh, well, you know, I got there. That's no big deal. I will take it from there. I will forget about my intermediate state that I was expecting here, and then I make a new plan to get to my goal by a different route. Which option you pick, of course, depends on many factors, but depends on your knowledge, understanding of the system, and how you're able to predict how it's going to behave. To predict how it's going to behave, it has to have a consistent behavior that you have learned through repetition. And so the reason we insist on building systems that are consistent is so that people can trust them and don't have to undo every time something goes wrong because they just don't understand how it works. The way you think your system will be understood, of course, is not the way it will be understood by the real users. And that's why we need extensive user testing so that people can tell you, you know, what's wrong with your design, or so you can realize what's wrong with your design, and that you can create more consistent and predictable system. Once the system is predictable, it will feel easy to use. In other words, ease of use, it's not an internal property of a system. It's a relationship between how the system is designed and how its actual users will experience it. Okay? Any burning question? Well, I'm going to leave you, hopefully, with Raphael and Emmanuel. Here they are. So I held my promise. I did the Norman stages of action.
Okay. Not too tight.
What?
Not too tight for the class.
I'll survive. The question is, are they tired?